Hello, this is Gerd Leonhard, futurist and author of Technology versus Humanity. We're doing another podcast today with my friend and colleague Peter Van, who's the curator at the Futures Agency. This is on digital ethics, chapter 10 in my book, techversushuman.com. And hello, Peter. And
thanks. Hello, Gerd.
Hello. And the subtitle of the chapter is Technology Has No Ethics, But Humanity Depends on Them. Obviously a timely topic, given the recent discussion about digital ethics. So take it away, Peter.
It's a very juicy chapter in your book, and only the subtitle, as you just mentioned, it is probably worth discussing an hour about it. But you start off.
We only have 5 hours, so.
Yes. Okay. Well, you start basically by depicting the technology evolution and how we are just in couple of 10 years moving very fast, and changes pivoting from 4 to 128 and 186. So what are those changes? Why are they so big?
Well, I think that, you know, the thing is about what happened with technology until, say, 10 years ago is that most of it didn't really work very well. So the whole ethical discussion was a little bit theoretical, like, you know, if you're going to talk about people getting addicted to mobile devices or virtuality, you know, none of that really worked so well. So the battery would be dead after a day. Right? How you can't get addicted to that. You know? It was good. But now, basically, everything is leaping. Everything is becoming so powerful and cheap. And this is only the beginning. I mean, in the very near future, we have unlimited computing power, unlimited bandwidth, and unlimited throughput, and unlimited storage. Mm-hmm. And so the ethical questions that were kind of theoretical 5 years ago or 10 years ago are very big now. And as you could see with the recent discussions about social media, Facebook, and the responsibility of technology companies, when things really start working, then ethics become a huge issue because all of a sudden it's magnified. You know, it's actually mm-hmm. working. Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of definitions of ethics floating around. In your book, you mention a couple, like Larry Churchill's. That's a bioethicist who had a definition. And also, of course, Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics. Are those laws still pertinent today?
The laws of robotics, yeah, I mean, of course, you know, there's many new attempts at creating the laws. I mean, I like the definition of ethics the best that Demis Hassabis is using from DeepMind, who once said that, it wasn't him, it was somebody else, but he was riffing on it, as the definition of ethics is the difference between knowing what you have the power to do or the right to do and what is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And digital ethics is basically the possibility of knowing the difference between what you have the exponential technology to do and what you think is the right thing to do for humans. Mm-hmm. And so that's basically the whole idea of saying, yeah, it can be done, but should it be done? And that is the primary question, as I think Tim Cook said in his speech in the European Commission a few months ago. You know, technology can do great things, but it does not want to do great things.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't want anything.
It can't do anything. It doesn't have any desire. So if we want ethics, that has to come from us. I said in a recent video that technology will not solve political, social problems or any other problems that are human, because it actually amplifies them, you know, because it's efficient. So if there is, for example, efficiency in social media, it's mostly about creating an efficient way for people to distort reality, which is unethical in so many ways. That's why I left Facebook, right? Because I think Facebook is unethical. It's not necessarily criminal or so. It's just unethical.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of definition of ethics, or what you should do, it's not what you can do. It's about doing the right thing. Is it getting close to religion, or should we stay away from religion? I have the impression you say we should avoid bringing in religion into these debates.
I think religion is a much lower priority discussion when you talk about ethics. I mean, if you think about ethics as the capacity to think critically, right? about moral values, then moral values are much, much beyond religion, because they're much higher up. You know, like the Dalai Lama said, ethics is more important than religion. Mm-hmm. And he's a religious leader. Mm-hmm. I think religion is also much more about the things that should be or that have been defined as the right thing to do, and they're much more granular. I'm talking about human ethics, for example, very simple ethical principles, like, you know, respecting each other and leaving room for self-realization, and those kind of very basic things, you know, contentment. And you know, every religion wants that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, pretty much every religion wants that. So the capacity to think critically about values, I think that's going to be much more needed than to say, okay, because some people have said in the past that religions provide answers and ethics provide questions. Because religions have this capacity of basically explaining the world to you, and then if you believe in it, then it's all solved, right? Mm-hmm. And ethics don't really do that. So I think that is a tough discussion as soon as you get into religion. I would prefer that to be left out, because I think humanism, for example, is an ethical stance. It's not it could be spiritual, but it's definitely not religious. Mm-hmm.
I like that. Ethics is providing questions. I mean, I could riff on this, because it's like art. Good art is asking questions. It's not giving answers. Yeah. In your book, there are, I mean, in this chapter, there are three big chunks. Yeah? There are a couple of things that you suggest we should do, like I think you have listed 5 or 6 new human rights. Mm-hmm. Then there are a number of things we definitely should not do, like the don't go there principles. And then number 3, the big chunk, is your desire and your call to create a global digital ethics council. Mm-hmm. So I would like to keep the global digital ethics council for the later part of this podcast, and I would like to dive right away into the 5 new human rights for the digital age, as you call them. And you have been extremely careful in your book on taking a very humble position in daring to propose a number of new human rights. So shall you, I suggest you first give some background on why those new human rights, and then we go into each of them.
Yeah, I think that the background to the new human rights was primarily in the realization that these topics didn't really matter 10, 15 years ago, because these rights weren't threatened, you know, and it wasn't technically possible to augment people that easily. Except for, you know, only the really sort of pioneering cyborgs or those kind of things. But, you know, augmentation of humans, for example, is becoming a distinct reality, and lots of people will want to do that. And of course, the efficiency of markets forces people to augment, to be more competitive and to be optimized. Right? So that's the background of saying, you know, in the future, this is all becoming possible. So therefore, we have to carve out these places that protect us from too much of that happening. So, as I often say, too much of a good thing. You know? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So let's go right into them. There are 5. Mm-hmm. I'll just summarize them or list them, and then we go into each of them. So there's the right to remain natural, mm-hmm. the right to be inefficient, the right to disconnect, the right to be anonymous, and the right to employ or involve people instead of machines. So those are the 5. The first one, the right to remain natural.
Yeah, I think the underlying point of all of those rights is the discussion about inefficiency. You know, it's I think we're always using technology to become more efficient, to optimize, to make it faster, better, because it has economic benefit. You know, but when we do it too much of a good thing, then we're subverting ourselves to this desire to be like a machine. It becomes dehumanizing. So the first one, the right to remain natural, means that while you could argue when I take a cholesterol pill, I'm no longer being natural. You know, that's a weak argument, of course, because it's not that fundamental. But, you know, to really try to become less biological and to transcend humanity by, for example, always wearing augmented reality glasses or connecting my brain to the internet, I think that that should be something where we need the right to step away from that and say, no, we're not doing it, because it does have side effects. It's not all just a good thing. So the choice to exist unaugmented, that will become vastly important, because, you know, many employers in the very near future will want to force us to do this, just like they want to force us now to sit in front of the AR application to do a human resources test on aptitude and those kind of things, right? I mean, personally, I would never work for a company that puts me in front of a virtual reality screen that they can basically see what my facial expression looks like when I'm answering questions, yeah? I think that's dehumanizing. But then again, you know, I understand why people are doing it. But back to this whole discussion, you know, the right to remain natural. Mm-hmm. It's something that we need to enshrine in some way that says you cannot be discriminated against because you're choosing not to do this. And this will become really, really important in probably 5 years or so, when this will be part of the natural work environment.
Mm-hmm. And the next one, I mean, they all have to do, as you said in your introduction, to do with this drive for efficiency. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Efficiency should not be more important than humanity. And so the right that is derived from that is the right to be inefficient, mm-hmm. if and where it defines our basic humanness. So could you expand a bit on the if and where it defines our basic humanness?
Well, part of being human means that there's a process to things, you know, that we can't necessarily cut off the process. You know, there's a process to falling in love, there's a process to picking a partner, there's a process to creating art or music, and we can't just say that for efficiency's sake, let's cut off the labor, you know, the tough part, let's cut off the process, we can get to the goal right away. It's sort of like a Tinder for everything, you know, that sort of thing. And like, okay, I think I realize why you want things to be efficient, but you know, there are some things that just aren't efficient. The process of learning or creating wisdom or so, it's not efficient. Mm-hmm. The process of finding happiness is not efficient. It may be fast sometimes, but usually it's not.
And how would that right be expressed? Like in the previous case, you said, I would never want to work for an employer that forces me to sit in front of a VR screen. Mm-hmm. So how would this one translate in practice? What sort of things would you refuse to do or want to have the right to refuse to do?
Yeah, I think that the using technology to make sure that everything is optimized, for example, you know, in a work type situation that you are constantly in a virtual reality room because it's efficient and optimized for performance, for example, being a doctor, or working at a pharmacy or in healthcare or so, because that will make it much easier to move around and to look at data and so on. But imagine what would happen if you spent 8 hours in virtuality every day. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine what would happen to your brain.
Yeah, there's a big discussion in, especially in healthcare, already today, but it will only get worse, that we are losing the luxury or the right to have real care.
I think this is part of the discussion about cost. For example, if there's remote diagnostics in healthcare, which is coming, and I'm sure Apple and others will see to that. I'm very much for that. I think it's an amazing tool, but you know, should it mean that I have to have a special right to go see a doctor because the doctor will say, why didn't you stay at home and do this at home? Well, the answer is I want to talk to a person. Mm-hmm. Right? And I had some other concerns that I couldn't express in the app, right? And so we should make these things available totally, because it will make things cheaper and faster and better. But if I want to violate cheaper, faster, and better by being slower, I should still have the right to do so.
Yeah, so I would almost translate this right to be inefficient, which sounds somewhat negative to me. It's the right to be personal, or to have access to personal care, if we would talk in an, which is not efficient, but it's much more fulfilling.
Yeah, well, I think efficiency and human contentment is sort of polar opposites in many ways, you know. I mean, we don't like inefficient things like, you know, late airplane arrivals or those kind of things, you know, trivial stuff, of course, right? But between people, efficiency doesn't really matter. It's not like you love your partner because they're efficient. I mean, you would hate the fact that they may be inefficient at times. So you could get grumpy about that, you know, but it's not some basic thing that you would say that it has to all be efficient, because efficiency is an economic paradigm, you know, and it has to do also with how technology has always been used to make things faster, better, cheaper, more efficient.
Yeah, it would be really interesting to have annual appraisal interviews with my wife on how efficient I was during the relationship this year.
Yeah, no, it's kind of like, okay, for humans, that we don't even talk about it. I mean, we may talk about it if you're always leaving your socks somewhere, or you're not doing your laundry right, or those kind of inefficiencies. But otherwise, you know, we laugh about this. It's not important. Yeah. And this is because humans aren't about data. Even though we use a lot of data, and sometimes we confuse that life is not a giant machine, and at least I don't believe it is. So, and this is why inefficiency is so important. Also, going to the other principles that we would allow inefficiency to keep on going. Like, hey, we may read the printed newspaper, which is, God knows, very inefficient. But why do we do it? Well, there's another interface. It's maybe better for my brain, especially when it's not 15. And so, you know, not everybody wants to learn things in the virtual reality game. And of course, that's fragmentation. So I think if we need a right for that, we would have to say, well, we cannot make this a requirement. Like, we cannot say that you must reach a certain efficiency level so that you can even have a job or be part of society, or like voting, right? You're going to have electronic voting. I'm all for that. But there's some reasons why electronic voting may actually prevent people from voting, or may make it less serious, or may the interface may change the outcome. There's lots of debates about that. You know, it's so efficiency has to always be balanced by humanity. And that, so if you're a politician or a lawmaker or a policymaker, you have to say, well, you know, is this, maybe it's more human to leave it inefficient. Right. Could be.
The next one is the right to disconnect. I mean, there are probably now 100 books on disconnecting and detoxing, etc. So it starts feeling like a sort of, well, luxury or even new form of snobism.
Well, I think that, you know, if you look at all the propaganda from telecom and mobile companies in the last 2 decades, it's all about, you know, you connect and you unlock this vast universe of possibilities, and you become powerful and your GDP goes up and all that stuff, right? And that's all good. But, you know, the flip side of over-connectivity, what I call digital obesity, you know, is that your brain gets fat, just like a body gets fat when you eat all the time. You know? And that's not human. It's humans are not in the position to constantly inhale from the fire hose of information. Because that's just not how we work. I mean, it's just like saying, okay, the reason that people are obese, well, some of them at least, is the constant availability and the craving for food. And all kinds of course, medical contexts with all of those things, and including diabetes and so on. But, you know, 60% of Americans are overweight or obese. And so this is a major issue, I think, for us when we become digitally obese. We need to disconnect and say, I have to digest this. I have to actually find myself again.
So in the same way that I expanded your right to be inefficient to the right to be personal, I could take this right to disconnect, and it's almost the right to stop pretending. There was a great post last week by Dark Mountain on this and go back to what they called the kitchen table conversations. So it's human to human.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me of, you know, what Zuckerberg recently said about Facebook going from the town square to the living room. You know, to me, that's like a threat. That's not, that doesn't sound very hopeful.
You don't want Facebook at your kitchen table.
You know, yeah, at the kitchen table, and then God knows in the bedroom, right?
Yeah.
And in my head, I found Facebook in my head, right? Mm-hmm. When they have this this new way of predicting what I may think. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to me, that's kind of, I must have the right to disconnect. So that means I can't be found, I can't be seen. And that's something that we have to enshrine in some way that says you're not going to be punished for not connecting all the time. Yeah? And it's this kind of like, you could think of this as like a natural park for humans, you know, like a, I sometimes call this the EPA for humanity. Mm-hmm. Protecting humanity in such a way that says, okay, go off and do something that you used to do before there was all this connectivity. I mean, imagine a world of 5G. 10 years from now, we have 99 billion people connected to the internet and at high speed. Yeah. And that's a question of keeping, you know, keeping your health and keeping what is human. And that goes for the next one, the right to be anonymous.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So I think that is absolutely crucial. Privacy is not dead. It's different, of course. But I don't see why we have to declare privacy dead just because we want to have the benefit of connecting.
Well, there is also recently this whole dispute of what's going on in Toronto with Google's Alphabet's subsidiary Sidelabs. Mm-hmm. And I saw they were now proposing like labels or stickers, mm-hmm, that are informing you on how you are being tracked. So the question is not anymore if you're being tracked, but there's no way to consent to anything. Your only right is to look at the sticker and being made aware that you are tracked by a camera or by a voice or by whatever means today. Mm-hmm. So how realistic is this to, in that sort of Sidelab scenario, to be anonymous or to be disconnected?
Yeah, this is a difficult question because, of course, you know, the benefits of monitoring and tracking are obvious, whether they're good or bad intended. So I think this is a difficult discussion about what should be done, for example, anonymizing data, right? Or what is the requirement of governments to use the smart city applications and the Internet of Things? And I think the problem is that it's so tempting to use that in so many ways once you have it, that the temptation is literally trillions of dollars found in new ways. And if you're a government, then the temptation is that you think you're much more secure when you do all these things. Right? So I think it's a huge challenge, the anonymous part and the, you know, this whole, I mean, this is not new, but the discussion between freedom and control, right? Mm-hmm. is old. Right?
Yeah, and the whole, I mean, it's related to the GDPR and the whole suggestion of being able in control by having given consent. I mean, yeah, it doesn't work in a Sidelab scenario anymore.
No, I think that, and I think this ultimately, it may be good intention on those that provide it, but it could so easily be abused that you would say like, okay, you can turn this around and then all of a sudden it's the biggest panopticon ever invented. Mm-hmm. And who would you trust with that? Is there going to be any supervision? Do we have a UN rapporteur for surveillance, for digital surveillance? And what power would that rapporteur have? I mean, yeah. So we're going to need global standards for this also. That says, for example, that we can do this for all kinds of reasons. For example, orchestrating traffic flow and those kind of things. But we couldn't use it to pursue people. And of course, this is a highly contentious area, given that both the laws in the U.S. and also China pretty much allow for, you know, anyone to do any of those things anytime. Mm-hmm. And here in Europe, it's not. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's obviously a difficult. This is probably the most difficult thing to realize. You know, yeah.
So in your call for a global digital ethics council. So one of the things that this council would do is to articulate a number of rights, like the five rights that you have listed in your book, but also to articulate a number of you shall not things. Mm-hmm. So you have 15 shall nots. Mm-hmm. In your book, we're not going to go through all of them. But let's take the first one as an example. You shall not require or plan for humans to gradually become technology themselves. In practice, we can say that, but how would you detail that? How would you enforce that?
Well, I think that, you know, if you, the only way this such an ethics council would work is that it would eventually have some power of intervention. So just like the UN is now saying, you know what, you may not have this intention, but if you put this weapon here that, you know, this is highly contentious and we don't like it, and you got to go back and adjust your actions to the international community, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you're creating a product that basically tempts people to shift themselves out of reality, like the Google Assistant, okay, mm-hmm. That's a great example. I think it's harmless now, but when you think of the reality of the assistant becoming your digital assistant in such a way where you're as dependent on that as you are on Gmail or Google Maps, right? Mm-hmm. Then eventually you'd have to say, you know, if you've taken this all the way to the extreme, that is kind of a plan to replace human interaction with machine-based interaction, and it has to stop at a certain point. Right? And that is basically saying, okay, there needs to be a dividing line that says, okay, beyond this, we don't go. It's not black or white. It's, you know, it's always somewhere in the middle. So just like we have now many cases that the UN discusses that are not just black or white, but there are some really black cases, like you shall not have a nuclear weapon if you're a small independent state, just because you have the money. You know? So that I think is obviously a huge drop. And I think just by discussing it and having public debate about this, a lot of these things would sort of regulate themselves by social contract. You know, China came out with the CRISPR-Cas9 operation, parentheses, that the doctor undertook to save the two babies from HIV. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese government did not, as many had expected, applaud the doctor, or they did not say that China is ahead and this can be done now. But they put the guy to jail, and now he's under house arrest, I think, right? Mm. So they basically did not deviate from the international academic standard. And they said, okay, China can do this, and we probably will, but this isn't right.
Yeah. But what you're trying to create with the Digital Ethics Council, it's not an academic exercise. It's a... It's a group of, as you call it, wise people from different origins, different gender, different cultures that would set those blurred red lines not to cross.
Well, yeah, they would. I mean, I think that I imagine a situation where the Ethics Council would say, okay, after much debating, we think that a human that is less than 44% original equipment is no longer human. Right? And yeah, you would set such a standard. That would be the opinion of the Ethics Council, and then people could ignore it, but it probably wouldn't, just like they don't ignore the warnings of the UN Security Council. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think these are much more complicated things than many of the practical things of the Security Council and so on. Right? And so they would take a while to deliberate. You know, for example, as I say in number 4 and 5 here, you know, we shall not empower machines to empower themselves. Mm-hmm. So we should not allow recursive development of machines to where machines can basically upgrade themselves.
Because it's already happening now. Hmm? It's already happening now.
Yeah, except that they aren't that intelligent to begin with. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a machine with an IQ of a million, which is 20 years away, that machine is not human. It does not really think. It doesn't have consciousness. But with an IQ of a million, it could probably figure out how to simulate it. Mm-hmm. If we let it, you know, recursively improve itself. So there are certain rules that we have to hammer out what they would be. And I grant that they would not be easy in some cases. But, you know, a very simple rule is quite clearly we should not have machines that automate killing without human intervention. Mm-hmm. We just shouldn't, because, yes, it can be done and it may even save lives, but it's dehumanizing. Mm-hmm. And so I think if we have such a council putting forth those things, then eventually I think that results in sort of the concept of a world government, you know, mm-hmm. Which of course these people wouldn't be governing, but they would basically also intervene, like a rapporteur has the power to
it's like the tribunal of Den Haag almost.
Yeah, except for that it's about soft issues, you know, it's not about laws, it's about what do we want to achieve. And I think, you know, if you see what's happening today, we have a lot of global collaboration on so many issues. And people always say that we don't have that, but we have it on many, many things, because in the end, we do kind of, most of us want very much the same thing. There's things that some people may want that's different in terms of how the embodiment of what they want, right? But, you know, basic human things, I think we can get on the same page that everybody should have water and food and energy, you know? And how we do those kind of things. So, yeah, I think that's inevitable, because otherwise we're looking at the weaponization of all of those things.
And but that will be couldn't you automate such a digital ethics council? I mean, you can probably program the rules in some sort of algorithm, or is that against number 13, which says we shall not require robots to make moral decisions?
I think that's the sort of a law of robotics that I came up with as part of the book. I think we could program robots to understand this, but think about this for a second. I mean, a human looks at intractable problems, you know, problems of infinite nature. And a human says, you know what, I have to decide in 5 minutes, and this is what I'm going to decide, intractable or not. This is really what I think is the right thing to do. It's not logical. It's more spiritual. It's more intuition. It's more imagination. And that's what I want to maintain. I even want to maintain it if it's wrong, ultimately. Because the judgment of saying that everything has to be right in retrospect leads to a machine society, right? We make mistakes, we pay for the mistakes. We had 2 nuclear bombs, we have climate change, we have global warming. We can learn, we have to learn, we have to improve, and then we make more mistakes, except we shouldn't make the existential mistake of having AGI, the number one goal of every government in the world. You know, that is a mistake we can't survive. So that's why I'm saying this human part of imagination, intuition, mistakes, mystery needs to be maintained.
Yeah, of course, the other side will say, well, you want to make decisions in like 5 minutes, but we can make them in 5 milliseconds. Wouldn't that be better?
Yeah, but only for non-material things. For example, you know, if your wife is 1 week pregnant, and you found out through some sort of fancy gadget test that will be available in the future, and then you can check the DNA, you know, yours and the embryos, and the machine can say, you know what, there's a pretty slim big chance that this person will not be very intelligent. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what is that supposed to mean? Is that like, you know, worth less or worth more? Or, you know, is it a green light, a red light, or what? I mean, there has to be some sort of bottom line where we say, you know what, there's a right to do this regardless of what the data says, because the data may actually not be correct. It may inadvertently, because we're not machines, still be different.
Yeah. So under the shower, morning shower, you get sometimes this sort of ID. Not this morning, but another morning. I found that the essence of a lot of what you're writing is about the whole data way of dealing with things. It's purely statistical based. It's on past experience. And you have a quote in your book that you said the future shall not be an extension of the past, but the whole data way of dealing with things, it's a pure statistical machinery, and humans are not statistical machineries.
Yeah, I think that's the underlying argument. Of course, you know, people may argue that we are just machines, and I wouldn't necessarily argue that we're not eventually going to be discovered as machines, but I think that's at least 100 years away. And my argument is always to say, well, you know, right now I can't see that we are machines in the same way that the computer is a machine, because there's such a huge material difference. We may in 100 years have the convergence of those two things. Yeah, that could be possible. But then I would argue that we wouldn't want that to be the same, that we would want to maintain the difference in some way. Right? Even if it was the case. So right now it's not material, because I don't think we are anywhere close to the machines that we have created. And people tend to always believe data more than they believe their own feelings.
Mm-hmm. To come back on the right to be disconnected, or the right to not be driven by algorithms, I think you're hinting in the book, which was written published in 2016, but I know you are making updates all the time. There is a new sort of digital divide that may be possible, that only the people who have the money have access to these rights to be disconnected or algorithmic free, etc.
Of course, you know, I think that's the irony of exponential progress, that first we have people who build these fancy setups and they own it, and then they make literally 4,000 millionaires in one day when they go public, and then they have enough money to leave that very world that they have created. Mm-hmm. Because they can remove themselves from what everybody else has to live in by the fact that they own what has been created. Mm-hmm. So that they have to live in it. Mm-hmm. And that to me is detrimental to the effect that you're basically going to say, well, privacy has always been for rich people. You can, mm-hmm. or keep yourself separate from the mainstream, da da da, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think to some degree that's, yeah, if you want to have fancy security, you pay for that extra, that's fine. But basic human things, they should not be for sale. They should not mm-hmm. be, you know, that is something that the government has to protect on our behalf. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that will take a lot of wisdom from governments, because, you know, they want more revenues, they want more jobs. But I mean, think about the logic. You know, you're going to have more money and possibly more jobs, but then nobody is really human anymore. What is the benefit of that? I can't see the benefit of that. I'd rather have a society that has great benefit from automation and from technology, redistributing the benefit, for example, through a basic income, so that we are all in a position to do other things. And then we can talk about that. Yeah? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the logic of saying that we're going to have to pay, and if you can't pay, then you're just out of luck. Like you're just out of luck because you can't have a powerboat, you know, or a Maserati. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. different.
Mm-hmm. I think you don't have to answer, but I think I know who you're going to vote for at the upcoming European elections. Joking aside, there is nothing, but absolutely nothing about that I have seen in any of the European parties' programs for the upcoming elections that talks about this technology versus humanity aspect.
I think it's still a little bit early. What we have right now is the discussion about digital ethics and, of course, the ethics of AI, like mm-hmm. recently the Google Council. And I've proposed Google, well, if they were pay attention, they're probably not, but that, you know, that Google should put their money and their weight behind a digital ethics council.
You did?
Hmm? Yeah, and they should be founding it in a way to say, okay, you know, what if we have the top 50 tech companies in the world founding such a council? Yeah, it would be tedious, but at least they wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't be looked at as self-serving. You know? Yeah. I mean, I think the idea of having an ethics council within one company is a good step. But really, I mean, these issues are much larger than what any one company has to discuss, because they become humanly existential. And we should really only in the beginning be very modest about the goals, you know, like prohibiting weapons that can kill on their own and things like that, you know, really objective things.
Yeah, but in the end, maybe the Digital Ethics Council is one of the steps, but in the end, it has to land on the political agenda.
Absolutely. But, you know, politics is also changing because of technology. So politics used to be in many ways disconnected from lots of science and technology and industry, because it didn't really impact many of those things except for on the economic side. But now we're talking about very, very basic fundamental human things. So if a politician, in my view, should have a driver's license for the future. I've talked about that many times before. Pass the future test. Even if you want to be a mayor, you should pass the future test. And politics is now basically becoming much wider, because if you don't have foresight in politics, which is kind of an oxymoron, I guess, right? An antidote. if you don't have foresight, you're going to cause a lot of damage.
And then you may end up in hell.
Yeah, you may end up in a place to where, like the Oppenheimer effect, right? Yeah, I didn't know what I was doing, but I thought it was good, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think this is really important, and this is why I'm trying to get more politicians to, of course, to read the book and to see the book, but also to think about these things, because I know it's hard when you're looking at so many pressing things that are around us every single day. Like, you know, in Switzerland here, we have discussion about copyright law. Mm-hmm. We have discussion about tax reform and European assimilation of European law and those kind of things. They're also important topics. But are we talking about the future of work or education based on technology? Are we talking about what's going to happen when we put $300 million into a robotics learning facility? And have we talked about the general outlook on life, you know, when we're building giant machines to automate everything? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So those are much larger topics than, you know, if people are going to download songs for free. and I think we have to move beyond that and say, okay, what is really important for humans?
Yeah, Finland is going in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And so is Denmark. Of course, the Nordic countries have a leg up on this. Mm-hmm. Clearly, I think the European Commission does a lot of great work in this regard. And this is, you know, the Digital Ethics Organization, I think, at Oxford, and of course, the Future of Life, and all these kind of organizations are doing great work in this regard. But this has to become a mainstream topic. Mm-hmm. You know, these are not just, I mean, we're talking about the very definition of what it means to be human. That is what we're going to be discussing.
Very important topic. Gert, it's the core of your book. It's a must read. So I think it's about time to wrap up.
So if you want to find out more, your millions of listeners out there, is digitalethics.co is now an archive page of our newsletter, which has been put there, and a bunch of other videos and stuff are going to go there as well. That's sort of the hub on my website. And of course, my book is Technology versus Humanity. It's available in 11 languages, and you can find out more at tech versus techvshuman.com, and I'm at futurewithgert.com. Peter is at Peter Van, right, on Twitter.
Right.
And we're going to keep on with the podcast on a weekly basis until the book is exhausted, which is very soon. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, we're going to shift to some current topics for the weekly debate on this. And Peter and myself are available for keynotes and conversations, of course, on these topics and fireside chats. We're doing a new format, the two of us, which will debut in Bucharest in about 2 months or so. Mm-hmm. So anyway, thanks for tuning in, and I hope to see you down the road. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Gert, for being. Bye. Bye-bye. Bye.